Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to be joining you yet again for another one of these fun-filled, for us, evenings together. I'd like to go ahead and jump in to the episode because we've got some interesting things to talk about this week. And I will, first off, of course, always introduce Sam Bradley, who helps bring all of this together. I mean, you guys don't know, but she is literally the glue that holds the show together.
Aw, thanks, Jamie. I appreciate that. No, we got a good team here, and everybody does their part. And it's like that a three-legged stool. If you're missing a leg, you got a problem. But I think we got all of the legs, so we're good. So I guess you guys have had fairly mild weather, but I was just telling Kyle about the amazing lightning show here in Colorado. Did you get some of that, Kyle, up there in the mountains?
Yeah, Sam, definitely did. We've had some good thunderstorms roll through the past couple of days, and that's brought, like you said, the beautiful lightning to look at. Also dangerous, of course, if you're out and about, but some pretty high winds, too, here in the mountains.
Oh, yeah, we had that, too. What are we looking like for the next week?
Well, Sam, looking ahead weather-wise, just looking at things as they're unfolding today, pretty active out on the Central Plains. If any of you are watching that, or perhaps you know someone who's out chasing it, we do have several big thunderstorms ongoing, producing mostly large hail, but a few tornadoes mixed in. And we're probably going to have a lot more to talk about as we get into next week's episode recording, because there's still two more days of widespread severe weather all the way from the southern plains up through the Midwest in the forecast. On the flip side of things, breaking from that, going to the fire weather side of things, the Southwest United States continues to be under drought conditions, and that's resulting in fire weather conditions that are going to persist probably through the majority of the summer here. It's going to take a lot to overcome that. So if you know the wind starts blowing, you're likely to hear the phrase red flag warning. That might mean something a little different to you if you're a beachgoer, but we're referring to that in the fire weather sense. So just know kind of where those alerts are coming from, and just be careful if you're recreating outside. I know the campfires are great, but be smart about it. That's all I'll say from that side of things. But let's go with the disaster weather, Sam. Back to you.
Well, and actually, Kyle, I wanted really to bring good. Something up because I saw something on the national news weather recently. Looking at the spread of tornadoes so far this year, and they were remarking how unusual it was that up until I guess this morning or so, or maybe yesterday, at the time we recorded this, that there had been no tornadoes in Oklahoma and I think Missouri and Kansas, that normally they have tornadoes there many times by this point of the year. And it was very unusual to see this spread. They had more tornadoes in Georgia than, you know, they had 10 tornadoes in Georgia, like 9 tornadoes in Virginia, all across the Southeast, and none in the middle plains states where you expect tornadoes to happen.
Yes, I know that was a big topic for folks and all kinds of finger pointing and things, but I look at that as a blessing in disguise because, you know, as beautiful as tornadoes are to see when they form, any of us who have experienced those or responded to those know that it's ultimately affecting, you know, real people and disrupting real lives. So we've been very fortunate, but unfortunately, yes, looks like yesterday and today that trend is starting to flip and the Central Plains are becoming more active. We typically do see more tornadoes down in the Southeast United States in what's known as Dixie Alley in the early and later parts of the year. The tornado alley that we typically think of, say from Texas all the way up through the Dakotas and a little bit eastward from there, that typically sees and starts peaking and increasing in tornado frequency right around this time of year and then peaking in just a little bit. So hopefully we see a below average tornado year. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. We need to keep the perspective on, the effect that tornadoes have in a real sense. And and understand this was just a happy occurrence so far this year, at least.
Oh, heck yeah. And just like with hurricanes, you'll hear me say this, it only takes one.
Absolutely. That is so true. So, Sam, we move on to tonight's topic, and we kind of are going to be covering a variety of things around one central topic, aren't we?
Yes, we are. So I'm thinking, guys, we're well into our fifth year of this podcast, and a lot of people have probably joined later than sooner and don't know much about us and why we think we can do this podcast. So it might be a good idea just to give a little quick bio on who we are and who the hell we think we are. There you go. Let's start with Kyle. Go ahead, Kyle.
Well, I'll tell you, Sam. Hello, everyone out there listening to the Disaster Podcast. My name is Kyle Nelson, and I'm a meteorologist and social media and weather educator based in Aspen, Colorado. I have a background in emergency management and currently apply all those different things as a professional ski patroller, special event planner, and technical rescue coordinator for Aspen Ski Company. When I'm not doing that, I'm traveling across the U.S. Teaching emergency management, public safety professionals, and community leaders how to be more prepared for severe weather.
Yes, Kyle's a very interesting guy, and we've actually taught a class together, and that was great fun. We're lucky to have grabbed him and made him a regular on this podcast. So, Jamie, you're the head honcho here in terms of podcasting because that's what you do. Want to tell them more about yourself?
Well, I'm a paramedic and a nurse and a long time. I call myself a healthcare journalist, where I cover a lot of different healthcare topics via different podcasts that I'm involved with, and the Disaster Podcast being one of them for disaster responders. And so this is really something of a passion for me, is to try to get good, high-quality information out to everybody out there in the disaster response community so that you can be better prepared to deal with the things that you run into. And it's one of the reasons we're so happy to be partnered up with Paragon Medical Education Group and Joe Holly and the rest of the team there. And you'll get to hear from Joe here in a minute to introduce himself. But, you know, we talk all about making sure you, the responders, are prepared and as ready as you can be for those times when those unforeseen or even foreseen disasters strike your community.
Very good. Yes. And we do a lot of education on this show. And again, you're right. I have Joe talk about Paragon just a little bit. But I'm a longtime paramedic, worked the field for many years, was a paramedic supervisor. I worked for the state for a couple of years in disaster services, the state of California, that is. I am a DMAT training officer. That's a disaster medical assistance team. As we know, last year, Joe and I both got deployed for the hurricanes. I'm trying to kind of kick back a little bit here in Colorado and work from home and dog sit and do some of that and write my novels. And that's something that Jamie didn't mention. He's quite the novelist. He's got many novels out right now. But all of this is a segue to our Dr. Joe Holly and the amazing person he is, and he's probably blushing right now. But he's an ER doc. He's a USAR doc. He's keeper of dogs, and he's just an all-around good guy. So, Joe, tell us more about yourself, and tell us a little bit about Paragon and what Paragon does.
Oh, well, I'll be glad to. So, my full-time job, I guess, is EMS medical direction, and that incorporates the USAR role for me quite a bit, and I've been doing that for most of my professional career, I guess, probably over 20 years now. So I've been, lucky enough is the right word, to have been deployed to most of the major events from a disaster standpoint that have affected this country and others, going back, you know, for all the way back to Oklahoma City and others. So quite a long history of doing that. And, you know, Paragon is a sort of an offshoot of that, an effort to take the experiences of myself and many other highly successful and accomplished folks, and translate that into an educational experience for others who have not had much of an opportunity to do disaster work. And that really is the impetus behind Paragon. That has kind of grown in a lot of different directions, many that we didn't even foresee. And that, you know, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is the realism of our simulation work and the customizability of it all. And that has taken form in the use of cadavers in many of our labs. That has ultimately led to research on lots of various EMS-related topics. The one that I'm most passionate about is cardiac arrest and sort of using a cadaveric model to better understand the physiology of CPR and things that we can do in our quality of our CPR to affect neurologically intact survivors.
And that's exactly what we're going to talk about tonight, Joe. It's just kind of look at CPR from a little bit different angle. And when we're talking, I'm thinking back to when I started as a medic in the early 80s. Scary, isn't it? You know, we were required to do CPR on everybody, whether they, you know, it's almost like they're telling you, leave me the hell alone, it's time to go. But we didn't have a choice. And not only that has changed over the years, but just CPR itself, because so much more research has been done. And that's what you guys are doing now, making it just a little bit better. So what's some of the research that you guys have been doing? And I hear you had a paper come out recently, or you're working on getting it out. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, well, sure, I'll be glad to. So we did just receive notification from the journal Resuscitation that one of our papers has actually been posted on their online forum and is due for publication sometime in the next month or two. So I do a lot of collaborative work with some amazing people in Minneapolis, including Dr. Keith Lurie and Dr. Joanna Moore and Dimitri Yiannopoulos and many others who have been quite prolific academically over the years. And this paper was really looking at our attempts to develop a human cadaver model for cardiac arrest in which the changes that we had seen in the past in animal models, both live and cadaveric, from pressure changes and flow changes and all that sort of stuff, we can now reproduce in a human cadaver. The advantages to that are obviously from the obvious differences between an animal model and a human model, from anatomy and the way we do CPR and all that sort of stuff. So the establishment of this model gives us a platform by which we can look at the mechanical aspects of CPR, how we do CPR, and what things that we are doing, what kind of effect they are having on things like intracranial pressures, flows in the brain, all those sort of features. The only thing that the cadaveric model can't show, obviously, are the biochemical sides of cardiac arrest, as obviously there are no biochemical processes at work. So, you know, there are obviously some limitations to a cadaveric model, but they're much closer than anything else we've had before. And this is not research that is feasible to do in the field. You obviously can't stop a real cardiac arrest and randomize that patient to receive X kind of CPR versus Y kind of CPR. So, you know, it's a very, very difficult field to do research in. And I'm very proud of the really amazing folks that I work with, and what we hope will be a groundbreaking model for research on CPR techniques and adjuncts and techniques as we move forward in the future.
Well, we know all the strides that we've made, again, since I started in the field, as far as, you know, keep not only keeping people alive, but keeping their brain functioning, and that's really the whole goal. But how does that translate into a disaster situation where you're out in a post-earthquake or something in a USAR scenario? How would you treat that differently?
Well, you know, that's an extremely unique environment, obviously, where the resources are very limited, both in just sort of the number of people that you have, you know, with you to perform the work, but just as importantly, what are you going to do with that patient if sort of more definitive care is 8 hours away and, you know, means a boat ride and two hikes and a car ride and then a helicopter ride. So, you know, the challenges of cardiac arrest in a austere environment are really complicated. And I think warrant a fair amount of thought and consideration before you engage. I think there's a certain group of patients that may benefit from some resuscitative efforts. There are others that I'm not sure you can justify the commitment of resources. And then there those situations are incredibly fluid as well, as resources change and conditions change and all that sort of stuff. All of those things affect your ability to perform a cardiac arrest resuscitation in those circumstances, and certainly to do one successfully.
Well, would it also be true to say that, you know, generally, if it's a traumatic cause, they don't really come back very effectively, correct?
I would say in general that's true. You know, certainly if we come across a patient who has sustained a major blunt injury mechanism arrest, and, you know, we assess that patient quickly and they appear to be in cardiac arrest, the main thing I would do there is to stick a cardiac monitor on that patient and see if there's any cardiac activity. If there is no cardiac activity, then the chances of survival in that patient are zero. And it does not warrant, in my opinion, you know, the commitment of additional resources. If you do have cardiac activity, there is a very small group of those patients that may survive. Again, then you sort of shift into what resources do I have available? Where are they going to go? How close are they? How am I going to get them there? Is it worth the expense of you know, resources and time and people and risk to try to get those patients taken care of? And, you know, sometimes your goal may be an effort to resuscitate those patients from the standpoint of being an organ donor or something along those lines, when you realize that the likelihood that the patient itself will survive is not great.
Very true. So, Kyle, we're kind of looking at this from a different perspective, but having been a ski patroller, I didn't mention that, but Kyle is a ski patroller, and every once in a while, you'll get that older person that is, you know, at altitude and stressed out and unfortunately may have the big MI somewhere on the ski hill, which is complicated in terms of, you know, that toboggan ride down to the, you know, the patrol room or wherever you take them prior to getting them off to the hospital. So what's your experience with that, and how would that be handled?
Oh, Sam, that's a great question. Definitely a unique environment in the Alpine environment. So we're talking within the resort boundaries, not necessarily backcountry outside the resort boundaries. I don't have experience with medical cardiac arrests on the hill. We have had several patients that have that we've encountered that have different heart issues, we'll say. So something, you know, if there's one thing I've learned as a ski patroller, it's that the phrase "I don't feel good" is probably the most dangerous phrase that there is, because it can go from just, oh, maybe I've been sick, whatever, all the way to, wow, let's run a strip on you on a cardiac monitor. Oh my gosh, you know, something weird's going on. So
you're in deep end.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't know. This past season was an interesting one for that, but on how we handle that, we actually are very fortunate. Within Aspen Ski Company, each one of our four mountains has at least one Philips MRX cardiac monitor that we can deploy on the hill. With that, we can not only run 4 and 12 lead EKGs, but we are also able to do non-invasive blood pressure, end-tidal CO2 monitoring, and other vitals, so that we can get a pretty clear picture of that patient right there on the hill, whether they're out and exposed in the environment or in a restaurant or some other building or facility within the boundaries. From there, we're also very fortunate to have at least one paramedic on staff every single day at every mountain. So we have that high level of care that's available. And even if it's a BLS provider that hooks up the equipment and runs the strip when the paramedic arrives, they can interpret that, make a decision on what interventions may or may not be performed on scene, and then what the transport options are. And as you hinted at, Sam, it can be a little challenging when you're transporting someone down the hill, not just in a toboggan on a regular day, but say that it was a medical or some type of cardiac scenario where you were doing chest compressions. For that, we either have a CPR trailer that we tow behind a snowmobile that allows for providers to be on either side of a patient in a Stokes litter. We also have that we just acquired this past season is from Cascade Rescue. They have what they call the Trauma One toboggan. So think of your standard ski patrol toboggan, twice as wide and maybe 30% longer. And that allows for a rescuer to manage airway by the patient's head, and then a second rescuer to straddle that patient doing compressions as you're going down the hill. So we've drilled with those several times. It's a lot of fun to practice, and it's really one of those skills that I hope I'd never have to use. But should it occur, folks that are, if they're within the resort boundary and it's a witnessed medical arrest, you are very, very likely to have a positive outcome from that because of the capabilities we have within the resort.
Wow, I'm impressed. That's certainly much better patient care than we were able to do in my day.
And I'll tell you, Sam, it brings up to mind for me an understanding that it's important for you, the responder, to really have a good handle on what resources you have available. As Joe pointed out, even in those situations where there may be some viability of a cardiac arrest patient, you need to assess the viability of transport even after you get involved with taking care of this patient. So there are things that need to be kept in mind, that such as, do you have the accessibility to a heart monitor and a defibrillator, which would make a big difference in a situation of, say, a witness sudden cardiac arrest where someone collapsed on the hill, CPR was begun immediately, rapid intervention with a defibrillator would possibly begin resuscitation and revival of that patient to the point that they could be transported with a viable rhythm to the hospital with return of spontaneous circulation on the hill. And those situations, I think, would make a big difference.
No, absolutely. And like Joe said, it's not something you want to start if you're not able to follow through, especially if you don't have the resources. What are your thoughts on that, Joe?
Well, I think that's exactly the key. You know, I mean, clearly in these austere situations, the first of all, the chances of getting access to a patient in a true major disaster situation, getting access to them in a timely enough manner that there's really, you know, you're within the window where you actually might can make a difference is pretty rare, even in austere conditions like Kyle was talking about, you know, on a ski slope, you might be lucky enough to be close to a responder and therefore have an opportunity to intervene on those patients with the better chance of good outcome. But, you know, the more austere the environment, the more rural, the more wilderness, the more disaster, the less impact you're likely to have and the more risk that the responders themselves have to assume in order to move that patient, try to perform CPR on that patient while you are moving them, have enough equipment with you to manage all the many issues that are going on. And, you know, in Kyle's example, you know, it's not only cardiac arrest, but it's the effects of, you know, intense cold and weather and all of that sort of stuff. So it is an incredibly complex operation to respond to those folks and to do so with a successful outcome.
You bet. And Kyle just mentioned that he actually was involved in handling a traumatic cardiac arrest, and they got return of spontaneous circulation. Tell us about that, Kyle.
Well, Sam, this was a call that we had come in from multiple folks to our mountain dispatch, and immediately we could tell that, you know, something was definitely up. This wasn't just one of those isolated reports, and so we sent a patroller down to assess and discovered a person had collided with a tree. That patroller very quickly reported back and called what we call our code 99, which is essentially send the world, we call it. And that got all the resources on the hill, all the mountain departments rolling to assist us. And you talk about this from to keep in mind, this is during normal day-to-day operations. So this in total took 7 patrollers along with many other mountain departments to coordinate for this scene to actually have a positive outcome. When we arrived, you know, the patroller was, they had performed what we have in our protocol as our traumatic cardiac arrest protocol, critical interventions. So essentially controlling hemorrhage, splinting lung bone extremities, placing an airway, and essentially, and that patroller was also able to start an IV. So the theory being that we don't jump on the chest right away, like in a medical cardiac arrest, because, you know, it may be more of a container problem as opposed to a pump problem. So from there, once our paramedic arrived, we were able to place an advanced airway. I was begging that patient for full time that we were on the hill all down. And what actually resulted with the return of circulation was we applied needle decompression of the chest in the field. And as soon as that was done, that's the first time that one of our paramedics, who has 30 years of experience, he said it's the first time he's ever heard the hiss of air escaping from the chest. And you look at the cardiac monitor, sure enough, the heart was beating again. It was the craziest thing I've ever experienced. And it was an awesome way that we gave that person the chance to be reunited with their family.
Wow. Tension pneumo. Yeah, I mean, that's got to really feel good. What do you think about that protocol, Joe?
Oh, I think that's awesome. You know, and that's what it's going to take to do that, is to have that kind of response, to, you know, be able to throw that kind of resources at it quickly. And you know, obviously, in this case, it worked exactly like it was supposed to.
Oh, absolutely. That's good for you, man. I mean, even those of us in long careers, I mean, you could talk about actually saved, you know, count them on one hand in a lot of cases. So to have that experience is pretty. A question for you, and this is a concept I learned from you and that a lot of people probably don't understand, but as I'm in the middle of a 3-day thunderstorm right here, lightning strike injuries call for a whole different type of triage, where we learn, in general triage, cardiac arrest generally, for reasons we've discussed, lack of manpower and so forth, don't get managed before all the other people we can help. However, in a lightning injury, they have a thing called reverse triage. You want to explain that?
Sure. So I think that, you know, the idea here is sometimes in lightning strikes that are associated with cardiac arrest, that's an electrical injury to the heart, as well as the obvious burns and other problems that frequently come along with that. But, you know, certainly there's a significant electrical component. And the idea is that in patients who have suffered an injury like that, it may be worthwhile to attempt to resuscitate them first, with the idea that a defibrillator and honestly very little else may be enough to restart their heart and perhaps allow them to survive their injury, as opposed to someone who's had a cardiac arrest in an austere environment from some of the other stuff that we've been talking about. So, you know, I think the electrical injuries or lightning strikes may be a bit of the exception to the rule there.
Yeah, because generally, say this is a 23-year-old male. I mean, his heart's going to be basically healthy. If we can get it jump-started again, it's going to work. So, Kyle, what are your thoughts on that? You're the guy I learned that from.
Sam, that's definitely, I support that 100%. It's, you have to think about that with lightning. And one of the things that we have to remember is some of us coming from the urban setting into a non-urban setting as providers, as we're trained, lightning victims of lightning strikes, they don't hold a charge in the body. So being apprehensive about going out to, you know, assess them and treat them, really the big consideration should be scene safety. And I'm not talking holding up your hands and saying scene safety, BSI, and then walking forward. I'm talking about the environment in general, right? Are you coming out of your lightning safety location to go to this person, perhaps putting yourself in danger, but that person doesn't hold a charge. So getting on and assessing them immediately or as close to after that strike as possible is absolutely vital to ensuring a more positive outcome for that person.
Absolutely. So, Joe, where are you looking to go in the future with your research?
Well, I think I'm not sure we know the answer to that. I think the more we have looked into sort of the physiology of CPR, the more we appreciate there are things that we don't understand and many things that may impact how we do CPR, what things may affect flow to the brain. It just continues to maybe generate more questions than it does answers sometimes. So we're now looking, as a matter of fact, in the next month or two, we'll be doing some work looking at the effect of various kinds of airway devices on blood flow to the brain during a low flow state, such as cardiac arrest, and whether or not some of those airway devices may have a negative impact on blood flow through the carotids and or through the jugulars. So that may, that'll be very interesting. It may have a significant impact on what airway is recommended for use in cardiac arrest.
Wow, that's awesome. Like you say, it kind of finds its own direction based on what you're learning from.
It does indeed. It does indeed, yeah.
So, Jamie, you made a good comment as we wind down here, and I think this is a good way to wrap it up. Well, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just think, you know, we've talked a lot of things, and the common theme that I keep hearing from Joe, from Kyle, from you, from some of my own comments is that it requires an understanding of what resources you have available. It requires an understanding of your own skill set and the skill set of the responders with you. And it requires an understanding of general basic physiology of cardiac arrest. And what can be done and what cannot be done for a given patient in a certain situation. So we're really talking about applying critical thinking skills to a situation that in the past all too often has been treated with a cookie cutter approach. And I think that this is really a great example of how disaster medicine, austere medicine, wilderness medicine all really require us to focus ourselves on using our critical thinking skills to the utmost extent and applying our knowledge of what's going on with the patient in tandem with what we have available to help them and what can be brought to bear to help them in the long term. So I think that these, you know, it really comes down to critical thinking. And then that's my general thought to kind of wrap things up.
I agree. And with some of the chapters we looked at from Dr. Seth Hawkins' book, with more to come, anything that is in the austere disaster environment has to be treated differently. And that's why it's so hard for some people to come out of the hospital or off their fire engines or their ambulances and jump into that kind of scenario and expect that cookie cutter approach. And it just doesn't work. So every discussion we've had, I learned something new, and I assume all of us have to one extent or another. So, Jamie, go ahead and wrap this up.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I'd like to bring out here, and you know, certainly some of the topics that Joe's been discussing with his research and things, really brings to bear the importance of understanding what research-based medicine focused to your disaster response and how important that is, I guess. And so I think that it would be really great to kind of just talk to Joe briefly about what Paragon brings to the table when they talk about doing a customized training event for a given system and how focused your organization is on having that experiential and research-focused response modality so that you can teach that information and teach that type of critical thinking to the people you're training.
Well, you said that very beautifully, Jamie. You know, for us, it is all about the use of experienced folks who are grounded in the science and what the facts tell us about the best way to do things for the best outcome for our patients. And that's really our focus. So we work very hard to make certain that our instructors are deeply engaged, not only in the research side of things, but in response to disasters and et cetera. And then making certain that we stay up to date on the very rapidly changing science that's out there.
If folks want to find out more about what they can do to chat with you guys, and I think that that's the important thing here, is they really need to reach out and talk to you guys at Paragon Medical Education Group to understand that there are so many different things you can bring to the table for them that they may be missing out on some opportunities that they won't know about until they've actually made contact with you. So where can they find out more about what you're doing and more importantly, reach out and talk to you?
Well, we would absolutely love to talk to folks. You know, I think it is exactly a case of they don't know what they don't know and sort of what we can do for them. And so talking is the easiest way to kind of get past those preconceived notions or the idea that they just simply had no idea that we were able to do some of the things that we can do. So we would love to talk to people. You can find us on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group. And on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. And you can always reach out to us through Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. And thanks again for your continued support of the program.
Our pleasure.
Oh, no problem. Yeah. And Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to follow me on Twitter for the latest weather and social media and medical discussions, and also connect with me on LinkedIn as well.
Cool. Sam, how about you?
Well, I'm right there with Kyle in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on our Facebook group. And I'm hoping we'll get some feedback from our listeners on this discussion. And certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media settings out there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me there. And, of course, on our Disaster Podcast group on Facebook, just go ahead and search for Disaster Podcast and join. Ask to join the group. We'd love to have you join the community. We're over 600 strong there, and it's a great way to keep in touch with what we're doing, as well as visiting us over at disasterpodcast.com. You can find links there to subscribe to the show via your Android device, your iOS device, or other mobile platforms. We'd love to be able to connect with you and get you notified. You can also actually sign up for email updates that will let you know when new episodes are live. So all of those are great opportunities for you to find out more about what we're doing, and we want you to do that. You know, Sam, this has been a great discussion, and you know, it's important for us to revisit these physiological, clinical type discussions from time to time on different topics, to just kind of keep us grounded in the medicine, in the midst of all our other discussions of different types of response scenarios and things like that.
Oh, I totally agree. And it's nice to look at what we kind of consider an everyday protocol in EMS. You know, in different environments, that's going to change pretty radically. So again, it's another good example of disaster medicine not being our everyday medicine.